Hey y'all, I'm back with another episode of the Outlaw History Podcast. I said it right this time, I didn't even have to go back and re-record it. My guest this week is my friend and colleague, Sheila Rittenberry. We're going to have a conversation about sort of looking at Confederate Heritage Month 2019 in review, and we're going to have a larger conversation about the Civil War and about our individual research on Southern Unionists, which is something that we both work on. And of course, we're going to talk about the Lost Cause. Before I get into my conversation with Sheila, I want to mention, since my video went viral, I've gotten a lot of encouragement to produce more audio and other types of content. People are really enjoying what I'm doing. So I have started a Patreon to support the podcast and my other projects. So if you would like to contribute to the work I'm doing and the content that I'm creating, go to patreon.com/outlawhistory and give whatever support you can. You know, even if it's $1 a month, I would really appreciate that. If enough people offered $1 a month, I would be able to do quite a lot with that. I hope you check it out, and I hope you enjoy this week's podcast. Okay, here with my friend and colleague, Sheila Rittenberry. Sheila, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
You're an MA student here at the Texas A&M History Department, BA in History from St. Mary's College of California, a 13-year U.S. Air Force veteran.
Indeed, yeah.
You were an independent duty medical technician.
Yeah, so a little bit of a career shift, but yeah, it was a lot of fun, but time to move on.
How did you develop an interest in history? What's your sort of first memory of being interested in history as a subject?
Honestly, I hated history in high school, was not a fan of it when I first started going to college back in the 90s. But when I was active duty Air Force, I started doing my own genealogy, and that's what got me into Civil War history, which is what I do now. I was doing my genealogy. I found this guy who, there were a lot of newspaper articles about this guy, Tinker Dave. And I'm like, that sounds like an interesting dude.
The name has my attention.
Right? So I started looking, and I found just a handful of things about him. I'm like, I need to know more about this guy. And he eventually became my senior thesis.
Give us a short biography on
Tinker Dave. Tinker Dave was he was a farmer in, kind of on the border of Middle and East Tennessee around the Civil War, and tried to stay neutral for a while until the Confederates showed up at his house and threatened his wife and stole his horses and said, y'all need to choose a side, either join up with the Confederate Army or get out of the state. And he didn't like either of those choices, so he called a family meeting, rounded up a bunch of cousins and brothers and whoever else was in the county that wanted to resist the Confederacy, and formed a guerrilla band. There are some stories that say he's responsible for keeping the Confederacy off the Cumberland Plateau so that the Union Army could focus their efforts in other places.
That's really cool, and I guess that answers the question I was going to ask about how you ended up working on Union guerrillas in East Tennessee.
Yeah, it's a very specific thing, because I didn't even know there was a big Union population in East Tennessee.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
when I first started getting into the Civil War, because that wasn't something that we were taught in high school. It's not something that you're taught in your survey level history classes. And so I started finding this information about Tinker Dave, and yeah, it was a huge thing in East Tennessee. They actually tried to secede from Tennessee at one point because they didn't want to join the Confederacy.
I would really love to just be able to tell some of these neo-Confederate people to see the look on their face when you tell them that their ancestors were Unionists.
Oh yeah, it was scandalous in my family when I started doing my genealogy. I'm like, yeah, actually, we had two guys who fought for the Confederacy, and they were privates. But on the Union side, we had captains, and we had a lot of people who fought for the Union in my family. We're from Middle and East Tennessee.
I've heard that a lot. I'm trying to remember most of my comps reading list is just kind of run together, but I remember reading about these divided areas, and people are really, really surprised to learn that their ancestors were Unionists when they've been devoted Confederates all these years. And we're going to get into why. We're going to get into how that narrative came to be. This uniformity of sentiment among Southerners is
frustrating.
Yeah. This, I guess what we'll call Confederate nationalism became stronger after the Civil War than it ever was during the Civil War.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment.
We'll circle back around to that and talk about that more in a little bit, because we've got a talking point on that. Tell us about your relationship with the Lost Cause. You grew up in the South?
I grew up mostly in Texas.
Okay.
Yeah, and I grew up mostly in Texas, and then I went to California and did my undergraduate stuff in California. So I actually went to California, and my college professor was like, the cause of the Civil War was slavery, period, nothing else. And that was new information for me. I'm like, in public school in Texas, I went to college for a while in Tennessee. That's not the narrative that we got. And it wasn't even discussed that there was a whole lot beyond states' rights that led to that. And it was like the undergrads today are actually shocked when I tell them that in my high school, my senior year of high school, my class decided to call themselves the Rebels of 94 and made shirts with the Southern Cross and sold them to as many seniors as they could get to buy them.
Which was a lot.
Which was a lot. It was a lot, because this was Texas, but it was the 90s. We should have moved past a lot of this, but no one thought anything of it. It would have been a major scandal today someone did it.
I told a similar story in my TEDx about, you know, the college professor being one of the first people who I heard openly explain that this was a war about slavery. And that's a very common thing among college education Southerners, that they never hear that until, but that's why universities are bad and brainwashing people with, you know, facts and critical thinking skills.
That horrible liberal agenda of reading primary documents.
Horrible liberal agenda of getting people to think.
That's a terrible thing.
So April was barely want to dignify this terminology, and how do I do air quotes on a podcast? April is Confederate History Month, and you went on a little bit of a social media campaign doing daily responses to different elements of the Lost Cause.
Yeah. A friend of mine had posted a meme on Facebook saying, in honor of Confederate History Month, here's a picture of the last Confederate flag. And it was a white surrender flag.
It's classic.
I'm skeptical of anything that's posted in meme format. So the first thing I did was, well, is that true? Do Google search, is this, you know, Confederate History Month? And sure enough, in Texas, it was Confederate History Month, which wasn't even a thing until 1999. This wasn't something that was a relic of a bygone era. This was really recent, and I just couldn't let that stand. I couldn't let it go unanswered.
It seems like whenever Southern white people have a need to just be shitty about something, they default to some kind of Civil War commemoration. So you found, oh well, Confederate History Month is a thing that exists, and you decided to respond to it.
Yes. And being a historian, I set out to do the actual research, and all of my social media posts had sources at the end, and
that's great.
I had a whole campaign. I planned it out. I'm like, I'm going to start off with, here's why some of these states actually seceded from the Union and joined the Confederacy. In their words, why this happened. And I was just laying the groundwork to talk about the Lost Cause later on. Because I wanted to first establish, no, this was about slavery.
Absolutely.
In their own words, it was about slavery, period. End of story.
Yeah, I think I saw a TEDx where somebody made a similar point. So yeah, you start with the secession documents. South Carolina is a good one.
Texas was another good one.
Texas is a very good one. Mississippi's is good, too.
Yeah, I think Mississippi I used. And there was a fourth, because there's four that actually had documents listing out the reasons for secession. A lot of the other ones had informal documents, or they just didn't ever actually publish anything other than, see you guys, we're out, was what a lot of states did.
I looked at Arkansas just to see, and I assumed that this would be the case for other Upper South states as well. The Lower South states that seceded before Fort Sumter all seem to have, or most of them seem to have, explicit references to slavery in their secession documents. Yeah. Arkansas, and I assume other Upper South states, frame it as standing in solidarity with the South against the federal government. So Lower South states said, we're doing this to protect slavery. Upper South states said, we're doing this to help them protect slavery.
Essentially, yeah. It's
a gross oversimplification, but it's accurate. You said you saw the original meme about the final Confederate flag. I thought that you were going to go a different direction than that, because I actually went down that rabbit hole recently and found an article or something that was talking about the physical. It was a white towel that some Confederate staff officer carried into Union lines to send the message to Grant that Lee wanted to meet with him, so that would be the actual flag of surrender. And David Silkenat, who is he's a Civil War historian, and he teaches somewhere in the UK, and he's doing a book tour in the US right now. And what is that book called? I think it's called Raising the White Flag. It's about how surrender defined the Civil War, and it's on my list to read, and I have to read it soon before I get to have you in my dissertation. But I think he talks about the physical flag in that book, so that'll be something to look out for, and maybe something that I'll bring up again later when I know more about it. But see, I thought you were going to go in direction of the physical flag, but you were more baffled that Confederate Heritage Month existed.
Right. That was my thing, was like, how is this still a thing in 2019? And then it was, how did this become a thing in 1999? It was the kind of thing I would have expected to see.
1939?
Yeah, like in the 20s, or even like in the Civil Rights era, I could see it happening just as part of the white Southern backlash against people wanting their rights.
It is insanely windy just now outside. Wow. So, you started with state secession documents.
I started with state secession documents, and then I just did a few just general misconceptions about the war. I think I did some amusing things about the war, like the flag that is currently being held by Minnesota, the flag of the Army of Virginia, and they won't give it back. And Virginia wants this flag back because it was one of the flags of Lee's army.
Good for Minnesota. That was I don't have the full story in my memory, but people will know, and if you've ever been to Gettysburg National Military Park, there is this beautiful monument to the first Minnesota that just got mauled on the first day of Gettysburg. I recall that they were kind of in a wooded area, had kind of been disconnected from their brigade, and Winfield Scott Hancock finds this regiment, and he plugs them. He's going to plug them into the gap of the line. And this is the point when they're desperately trying to get reinforcements up from the Army of the Potomac. You've got, you know, Henry Heath's brigade just bearing down, and Hancock finds this regiment. And I think he's just something to the effect of, give me 20 minutes. And the 1st Minnesota bought 20 minutes at the cost of many, many lives. And I remember when I first saw this, I was on a staff ride with the West Point History Department, and one of the officers with us was talking about, this is something that he always points out to cadets, it's one of those questions of moral strength that military commanders have to answer, which is, how much is a life worth? How many lives are worth 20 minutes in a critical moment like that? So the experience of the 1st Minnesota at Gettysburg is a study in sacrifice for the greater position of your side.
Right, because if I recall correctly, it was at that battle that they captured this flag.
Yes, yes.
And Virginia wants it back, claiming, well, it's our heritage. That flag is our heritage. But Minnesota counters with, no, it's our heritage. We died and we bled
exactly
to capture this flag, and we're keeping it.
That was my position. Minnesota bought that flag. They have every right to it.
And it would be a disgrace and a dishonor to every Minnesotan that died to capture that if they were to just hand it back.
I wish that I could undo the... around the turn of the 20th century, when so many northern states gave the flags back to southern states, I wish they would have kept all of them.
Right. Well, and actually, oddly enough, Jefferson Davis actually is on record saying that it's military tradition where if you capture a flag of an enemy unit, that flag is yours and you don't give it back.
Well, say what you will about Jefferson Davis. He understood military principle well.
Right.
Did you have any particular favorite posts in response to Confederate Heritage Month? Any that really stuck out? Any that got a big reaction?
The Minnesota one was definitely one of my favorites. What was also fun was when I went towards the end and I started looking up notable Unionists from the southern states. Because all of these southerners who want to cling to this flag and cling to this Confederate identity that isn't even theirs, They all claim this as their heritage. The Confederacy is their heritage. And I wanted to come out with some of my posts and say, no, look at these Unionists who are from your state. They are your heritage. Tinker Dave and his little band of men keeping the Confederacy off the Cumberland Plateau, scouting the roads for Burnside, that's your heritage. Men like that.
So somebody on Twitter wanted to know, essentially, how does anyone justify supporting and propagating the memory of the Confederacy? My answer is, and I'll let you give your answer, my answer is that's what you get when you add resentment over failure, a victimhood complex, and white supremacism.
Yeah, I would have just simply said racism, but yeah. But yeah, it's more complex than just simple racism.
I put more ingredients into my explanations of collective delusions.
Yeah, it's a lot of, we want to believe that our imaginary ancestors were fighting for this great and noble cause, and that they weren't simply fighting to keep people enslaved.
Yeah, because there are so many books out there that explain how the Lost Cause was constructed, why, the methods. Gaines Foster's Ghost of the Confederacy, that's where you'll get your full dosage of everything that the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and especially the United Daughters of the Confederacy, everything that they did to establish Confederate idolization in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. Charles Regan Wilson has a book, and the name escapes me, but at this point was describing the Lost Cause as almost a civil religion in the South. And I've been seeing that a lot lately, references to the Lost Cause being a sort of secular religion. It is bizarre on the surface when you consider the course that Civil War memory took in its first 100 years. Is there any other conflict where the losers have set the terms of the narrative?
I don't think so. I think that's just a weird American thing that we've done. It's really bizarre to me.
But yet
I can't think of anyone else that's done it.
But yet we hate participation trophies in this country.
Oh, irony.
And what are Confederate monuments but the world's biggest participation trophies?
No, that was another thing that I went off on in my Confederate History Month post, is all of these statues that all of these people who want to cling to this ideal of, like, the noble Confederates want these statues to stay up, arguing that you're erasing history if you take this statue down. Like, no, there's plenty of other people in your state that you can put a statue up of. Plus, specifically, I talked about the statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest in Memphis.
The pink one that's been going around my Twitter feed so much, the one that's been painted pink.
Well, it's since been taken down. I'm sure it probably has been vandalized. I'm quite sure, but the argument is that if you take that, you know, taking it down is erasing history. But how many people have actually been to Memphis and gone to that specific park, seen the statue, read the plaque?
In my Twitter video that went viral, I made a crack about how I was going to do a rant about Nathan Bedford Forrest on a different day, and people seem to really want that rant. So eventually, yeah. I'm going to have to suck it up and do my research so I can do it properly. I just so resent having to have anything to do with Nathan Bedford Forrest. I've had this. It's almost like a recurring bad dream that has happened to me dozens of times in my lifetime. I will be in a bookstore or somewhere that's the topic of Civil War is going to come up, and I'll mention that I'm a Civil War historian, and of course, so you've got a history buff that they immediately want to start talking about Nathan Bedford Forrest, and I just it was like the time my wife and I were in line at the theater to see Lincoln when it was in the theaters, and there were these very sweet Arkansas old ladies in front of us, and we were chatting, and I mentioned that I studied history, and one of them brought up Bill O'Reilly's book Killing Lincoln, and I just completely gave up on the conversation, and I don't know what to say to that when we have established that we are so far apart on how we're even approaching this question. And that is how I feel about anyone who still perpetuates these myths about Nathan Bedford Forrest. So yeah, there's a little preview of a future rant. I don't feel like I was properly angry. I'm just resigned to it at this point, but eventually maybe the president will come out and praise Nathan Bedford Forrest, and I can get good and angry about it and do a proper rant.
Yeah, that would do it, I think.
Yeah, that was the other thing that was going around toward the end of the month was the president of the United States, such as there is one, made a statement about Robert E. Lee, the great Confederate general, and that spun into a million different conversations, and I had people asking me about it because this was right after my video went viral, and
that was crazy.
That was insane. That was truly insane. The president talking about Lee, Dinesh D'Souza, and other charlatans talking about this great general who lost the war so thoroughly that... Did you get in on the Lee controversy this time around?
I didn't. I need to be more active on Twitter than I have been, because that's where I put a lot of my rants about that sort of thing, simply because on my other social media, on my Facebook and things like that, I try to be a little more, let me teach you why you're wrong and stupid, rather than just, no, you're wrong and stupid, and that's what Twitter is for.
You can do both at the same time, I think.
It's a fine line.
Yeah, well, when this posts up, we'll get you some followers, and you can start helping me spread the good word.
Absolutely.
I tried not to get too heavily involved, because honestly, my assessment of Lee as a military commander, especially as his talent as an army commander as compared to every other general officer in the Confederacy, he is the best one by a lot. Yeah. There is no denying that Lee was the best field officer in the Confederacy. And if you look at his campaigns, he showed flashes of brilliance several times. But he also made really grievous mistakes, like everything he did at Gettysburg.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that, because of the emotional issues, the issues of historical memory that get tied up with Lee, it is hard for non-professionals to somewhat objectively assess his generalship.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who say that he's a great general don't know anything more about General Lee than that it was the name of the car on the Dukes of Hazzard, and that he was a general. I don't think a lot of people who have an opinion about him really know anything about, like, his command decisions and his tactical...
Other General Lee was a fantastic car.
Oh, it was a super car. Like, I was the exact right age to be totally into that, like, when it was all new.
Yeah, I caught it at the other end when it had the big revival in the 90s, when it was on...
I did not even see that. I was...
Right before Spike TV, when Spike TV was still the Nashville network. They would play Dukes of Hazzard reruns every day when I was in middle school, and so I got my chance to come around to Dukes of Hazzard, and I have them all on my media server, and I still go back and watch them. It's a very formulaic show, but it's
like I was like 7 years old in the early 80s with my friends from the neighborhood riding our big wheels up and down the street pretending we were the Dukes of Hazzard. It was amazing.
My mom had a 1994 Chevy Cavalier. And I would just get in it and roll the windows down and practice getting my little fat child self in and out of the windows.
Yeah, it was never as easy as they made it look.
No, it wasn't. This is the only podcast where you're going to get professional historians analyzing the Dukes of Hazzard. Let's get to the talking point that we were both sort of saving till we got all of the silly stuff out. Someone wanted to know about white Southern Unionists, which is a key research interest for both of us. So take it away. Tell us more about...
So my specialty is specifically the East Tennessee, and really just Tennessee in general Unionists, which I, like I said earlier, I had no idea that that was even a thing until I started doing my own genealogy. But in Tennessee, it was the state as a whole was pretty evenly divided on the issue of secession. And that's not something I had ever learned in school. Even when I was in college in Tennessee, that wasn't something that was brought up. But it was very evenly divided. And the first vote on whether to hold a secession convention actually didn't pass. And so the next election was likely, like, evidence points to the fact that it was rigged against the Unionists so that the convention would be held and the state could secede. What was interesting is, like, East Tennessee was the most Union-dense place in Tennessee. As you went west, as you got more in, you know, from the Appalachian foothills, as you went more towards Memphis, and you got more into the flatlands with the plantations where you were into the farming, it got more and more.
Okay, so I study Arkansas.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a similar situation in the cotton counties along the Mississippi River. And in southern Arkansas, where you can grow certain strains of upland cotton, strong plantation agriculture areas, those are the secessionist areas. In northwest Arkansas, the Ozark Plateau area, you have a very large proportion of Unionists. And it's the same in East Tennessee. It's Appalachian North Carolina, right, that whole area. Appalachian Georgia, North Georgia. So I have a hypothesis as to why that is that I'm pretty sure is the right answer. But what is your assessment on why certain areas of the South, and you can focus on East Tennessee, why is East Tennessee particularly prone to unionist sentiment?
Well, a big part of it is that their economy was less dependent on slavery, and so that wasn't that big of an issue. So when the rest of the South is making the issue of secession about slavery, that wasn't their fight. Like, they did not want to fight over whether or not those other guys are going to have slaves, because it wasn't practical for them have it in their family subsistence farms to have slaves.
He knew exactly where I was going.
Possibly.
It's the same Northwest Arkansas, very mountainous. There's no other way to put it. You can't grow cotton in the mountains, so you got no need for a bunch of slaves, so you don't have that much of a material interest in slavery, so you have no interest in fighting a rebellion against the United States to protect rich planters' right to own people.
Right, because even in the areas where you did have a lot more slavery, like in Western Tennessee, or down, you know, you go into Alabama and Georgia, where you have more people having slaves, you have these planters with large amounts of slaves. Even the people there who didn't own slaves were all for the institution of slavery.
Yes.
Because they had this idea that I might be poor right now, but one of these days, I'm going to make it. I'm going to be worth something. And you'll know that I'm worth something because I'm going to have slaves.
And that's the thing. And that's one of the favorite rationalizations of the Confederate apologists. That, oh, well, there's so many Confederate soldiers didn't own any slaves. Yeah, but they all really wanted to. That was their idea of success. That was the life that they aspired to.
Exactly.
Everyone who volunteered to fight in the Confederate Army knew what they were fighting for and were okay with it. Now, there are more complicated elements later in the war when we get into conscription. I'll have to have my buddy Nick Mosvick back on to talk about Confederate conscription sometime. But these guys knew what they were fighting for. They told us. They told us.
Oh, absolutely. In their own words. Like, they told us that they were fighting for the institution of slavery.
Alexander Stevens. Our new nation is founded upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, and that slavery is his natural and normal condition. They told us.
Absolutely.
But their descendants decided that their word wasn't good enough, and they started twisting things around. And they developed this narrative about states' rights and tyrannical federal governments and blah, blah, blah. There was that rhetoric at the time.
Right.
But people knew, and I bring up this point over and over again, the utter hypocrisy of the states' rights crowd. If you look at the South Carolina Ordinance of Secession, one of their explicit complaints as to why they're leaving the Union is because northern states exercise their states' rights by passing personal liberty laws to circumvent the fugitive slave law.
Exactly. They were concerned with their states' rights to have slaves.
That was literally the only one.
Yeah.
And they learned during the war, to their pain, that you cannot fight a war to establish a nation if you don't have a strong central government. How much of Jefferson Davis's entire tenure as Confederate president was a nightmare from having to deal with Confederate state governors? And there's been plenty of work about his relationships with the governor of Georgia, governor of North Carolina. One of the governors of Arkansas, and I'll write about that in my dissertation ad nauseum, after the Confederate defeat at the Battle of Pea Ridge in March 1862, the Confederate military in Arkansas leaves Arkansas, all of it, and that leads to Arkansas threatening to secede from the Confederacy. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, in a lot of the southern states, especially the border states, that was how they started losing a lot of support of the people, simply because the Confederate government and the Confederate military could not protect the people in their states from the Confederate guerrillas who were in the states.
I don't know if I can put that on my podcast because it's too much going into what I'm going to talk about in my dissertation. That is a big part of my research, is that in Arkansas, you have a very divided population. You have early in the war unionists being essentially forced to join the Confederate Army or bad things are going to happen to them and their families. Many of those people will end up deserting and find their way into the Union forces. And so the title of my dissertation, and I'm really proud of this, and there's a whole backstory as to this line. The title of my dissertation is Conditional Unionists, Conditional Confederates. Because when I first got here and did my coursework for my doctorate at Texas A&M, we had a historian, Dr. Walter Banger, who is now at University of Texas at Austin, but I had him for a readings class and a research seminar on Southwest borderlands. And I ended up thinking about how to put my own research on Arkansas, how to give it a borders perspective, and I have. But one thing that he pointed out to me, and I say it explicitly in my dissertation, it's one of my key points. The discourse surrounding the loyalties of white Southerners in the Civil War rests on the term conditional unionist. You have conditional unionists, you have unconditional unionists. But that obscures a very important point that I'm trying to expand on in my dissertation, and hopefully once I get it out, more people will start to expand on it. Well, by definition, conditional unionists were also conditional Confederates. And I'm looking forward to exploring a lot of examples of changes in loyalty among Arkansans over the course of the Civil War. I didn't mean to steal the question. Do you have more to say on that?
No, I don't think so.
Is there anything else we need to talk about? Is there any, what angles of the Lost Cause have we not attacked today?
There's so much.
There is.
With the Lost Cause, and that's something that I want to look further into in the future, because I think...
Yeah, and when I get better... When I get better at podcasting, we'll do a better podcast on it.
Fair enough.
Tell us where to find you on social media.
I am on Twitter at Shella_4711. That is really is my main social media presence right now. I think I'm also on Instagram is the same, but that's me taking pictures of architecture.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show with me.
Thank you for having me on your show. This has been fun.
You're welcome back anytime. Thanks again to my friend Shella Rittenberry for joining me on the podcast today to talk about all kinds of fun Civil War topics. Follow Shella on Twitter at Shella_4711. Follow me on Twitter, if you're not already, at Outlaw Historian. The podcast should now be available on most platforms. I know it's on Apple Music, it's on Google Podcast, it's on Overcast. To the best of my knowledge, it is now available wherever fine, easy for me to say. To the best of my knowledge, it is available wherever fine podcasts may be downloaded. So subscribe, reviews are a thing. I think every podcast that I listen to begs for 5-star reviews. I'm not going to do that, but do what's in your heart. Thank you guys so much for joining me for another episode of the Outlaw History Podcast. I'll be back next week, and I'll talk to y'all again after a while.